Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with indications that Donald Trump will be a hands-off president based on the chaos going on with the transition, in which Vice President-elect Mike Pence is doing the serious work while Trump does photo ops with a prizefighter and celebrity interviews for TMZ. Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy, and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, joins us. The author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, we will discuss what is needed to inspire the majority of Americans who did not vote for Donald Trump, who will soon be subject to the passage of a radical right-wing legislative agenda orchestrated by Mike Pence and pushed aggressively by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, that, along with a Supreme Court pact with reactionary corporatist judges approved by the Koch brothers, will make America great again for plutocrats and their heirs. Then we'll assess the new White House national security team that is rumored to be headed by General Michael Flynn as the president's national security advisor, with Senator Jeff Sessions and Senator Tom Cotton reported as leading contenders for Secretary of Defense. David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, who is a foreign affairs expert and a former senior advisor to the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, joins us to discuss his latest article at the Huffington Post, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn, Gun for Hire. Then finally, John Densmore, an original and founding member of The Doors, who co-wrote and produced numerous gold and platinum albums, joins us to discuss how the emergence of Trump brings back echoes of his early resistance to the Vietnam War and his fellow radical anti-Vietnam War activist, the poet Robert Bly, who became the leader of the 1990s men's movement. We will discuss the new film, Robert Bly, A Thousand Years of Joy, and how much Donald Trump is a throwback to the chauvinistic male patriarch his father was, and the tragedy that America came close to having a woman lead the nation, but for the last-minute intervention of the right-wing Republican patriarchy inside the FBI. And joining us now is Timothy McCarthy, who is a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. An award-winning scholar, teacher, and public servant, he is the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Prophets of Protest, Reconsidering the History of American Abolitionism, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy McCarthy.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And not necessarily the greatest of times, though, would you say? Almost everybody I know is somewhat in shock. Some even seem to have a political form of PTSD.
Well, these are certainly not the best of times, Ian. We're definitely, for some of us, feeling like we're in the worst of times. But we've been here before. Our nation's history is not one of that is absent of struggle and difficult times. So we'll get through this, I think.
But have we ever had this disconnect or this disparity where you have the loser of an election winning 2 million more votes than the winner, and then the winners essentially pushing through an extremely aggressive far right-wing agenda that definitely seems to be on the cards, that does not reflect the wishes of the majority?
Well, I think that, I mean, certainly this is the second time in the last 20 years, where we've had the loser win more votes in the popular vote than the ultimate winner. And we see that Hillary Clinton's number of votes, her vote advantage in the popular vote is rising by the day as we gather more data and have more accurate information about who voted and who didn't. And so obviously that's disturbing. But, you know, this isn't, you know, we knew the Electoral College existed, and I think it doesn't serve us too much, too well to be hashing out whether or not the Electoral College should exist, because it does, and we knew that going in, and the Clinton campaign knew that going in, and most of us who voted knew that going in. So I don't think we should spend an enormous amount of time right now hashing out whether or not the Electoral College should exist. I think we should know the history of the Electoral College before we do that. But that said, I think that it is important to state with a full throat that this is no mandate for Donald Trump, that even if the electors vote in accordance with how things turned out in the Electoral College, and Donald Trump is indeed installed and inaugurated as President of the United States, he doesn't come into this role with a mandate. He certainly is acting like he has a mandate, and those around him are acting like there's a mandate, both those who already serve in Congress, people like Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and others in the leadership, and then people who are a part of his transition team, including Mike Pence, who's the vice president-elect and who all along has been a much more vocal and visible right-wing ideologue with vast political experience to his name and a long record of being on the attack against various groups of people that Donald Trump has merely insulted on Twitter for the last year or so. And so what I'm worried about is that so many Republicans who have vast experience in public life and in elected political positions are falling in line and working with the transition team to bring about a right-wing takeover of the government that is set up to be taken over with respect to Republican majorities in both houses of Congress, with the Supreme Court still lingering with the vacancy, and now a narcissist, sociopath, whatever you want to call Donald Trump, misogynist-in-chief at the helm.
Well, that's the question, though, isn't it, in whether or not Trump, in effect, has been a kind of useful idiot for the Republican establishment, which Mike Pence is certainly a part of. He's also very much a creature of the Koch brothers. They're all aggressively preparing legislation. Both Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan have said they're going to hit the ground running in early January. And based upon the meetings that President-elect Trump's been having in Trump Tower, with all of this disarray apparently going on with the transition, the fact that he's meeting with prize fighters and photo ops, and then doing interviews for TMZ, makes you wonder. While Pence is out there toiling in the fields, doing the Lord's work, it makes you wonder what kind of, whether or not, in fact, he will be some kind of figurehead in chief while the real work's done in the trenches by these, very seasoned Republican operatives who have a very distinct and definite agenda, and it's not one that the majority of the American people agree with.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, the American people, in terms of public opinion polls on a whole variety of issues, I mean, just take the public opinion shift on same-sex marriage and marriage equality over the course of the last decade. I mean, we know that the American public is moving more and more in the direction of progressive public policy views and desires. But the thing that is interesting about Trump, and I think the thing that's so troubling about Trump, I mean, there are many things. Obviously, we could be here all for another year on air talking about all the things that are troubling about Trump. But what's most troubling about him in terms of how he's going to govern is that we knew during the primary that, you know, there were inklings and of him not being particularly interested in being president and governing in that way. There was the story that was circulating in the primary that he had offered John Kasich the vice presidential slot, but that he could basically be president of the United States when it came to domestic policy, and that he wasn't particularly interested in governing. There's been this kind of sub-narrative all along throughout the primaries and in the general election that, you know, Trump doesn't really want to win. He doesn't really want to be president. He's not really interested in the job. We know from what we've been able to glean from his meeting with President Obama that President Obama was quite shocked at the lack of interest in governing and his lack of knowledge about a whole range of things and didn't even know what the scope of the job was. We know that he's not particularly intellectually curious. He's written a book or two, but I'm not sure if he's read one. And that is deeply concerning. I mean, the president of the United States has to be the hardest working person and the smartest person in the room. And Donald Trump is neither of those things. And so I worry very much that he's going to relinquish control, be really a kind of figurehead who can kind of continue to go about his business that he's been, to varying degrees successful with over the years, and then to relinquish control of governing to this kind of cohort or cabal of right-wing Republican radicals with Mike Pence really at the helm. And I think we should be deeply, deeply concerned about that. I mean, Mike Pence has a long record. I mean, I'm an LGBT American. I'm a feminist. I'm someone who cares deeply about reproductive rights and reproductive justice. I'm someone who cares deeply about civil rights for all people who are discriminated against and disenfranchised in some way. And Mike Pence has a long record of being on the assault, of leading the culture war against my own community and communities that I care about. I mean, there have been 200,000-plus donations to Planned Parenthood since last Tuesday's election, since last Wednesday's call to donate to Planned Parenthood in Mike Pence's name as an act of resistance to put our money where our movement is, to try to call out his assault, his war on women in Indiana. And the LGBT folks have also been in his crosshairs over the years. So, for folks who are in communities that are vulnerable, and there are lots of communities in this country that are vulnerable, African Americans, Latinos, immigrants, undocumented people, Muslims, LGBT Americans, women, all sorts of people, poor and working class people. I mean, we have a whole range of people that constitute both a demographic and electoral majority who are now in the crosshairs of American public policy. And that should be concerning to any of us. And it's not something that we should take lightly or laugh at or dismiss or hope that it isn't as bad as it seems. I think that one of the mistakes that certainly I think some leading Democrats are making right now is this kind of attempt to sort of all get along, the peaceful transition of power, let's give him a chance, and all of these calls for reconciliation that have been so quick to be voiced I think are deeply premature. I'm not saying that there should be a violent transition of power or a violent resistance to the transition of power, but I don't think that Trump's transition to power should be enabled by those of us on the liberal side of things or on the Democratic side of things or certainly on the left or progressive side of things, that we have to be forces of peaceful resistance to what we see mounting, but also that we know to exist. I mean, one of the things that I think is important for us to remind ourselves at this treacherous moment is that, this is the Trump presidency is the result of, a generation or more, two generations of public policy battles and cultural battles in the United States that have seen wholesale a rightward turn politically. That while we may be moving in a more progressive direction in terms of individual points of view or opinions about particular kinds of social issues or political issues or economic issues, we've seen in our government and in both of our political parties, both certainly the Republicans, but also in some ways in the Democratic Party, a rightward turn in terms of policymaking, where the kind of great liberal legislating and the great liberal political advances of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and of Harry Truman's Fair Deal and of the 1960s, starting with Kennedy and then moving to Johnson and even Nixon, who was far more progressive than any Republican working in American politics today, those visions, those liberal and progressive policy victories of the 1930s and 1960s have been eclipsed by a rightward turn that has been in some ways bipartisan, but certainly has been rooted in the modern Republican Party, beginning with the counter-revolution of Reagan, moving through Bush and now on the precipice of a Trump presidency.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Prophets of Protest, Reconsidering the History of American Abolitionism, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. And you mentioned, Timothy, the president's concern about Donald Trump's concentration or seriousness about the job that he's in. In fact, the president today, standing beside Angela Merkel at a press conference in Germany, said the presidency is a serious job, and if you are not serious about it, you will not last long. That seems like a shot across the bow, isn't it? Because you're hearing about, the possible impeachment of Trump because of we still don't know the extent of his relationship with Vladimir Putin and Russian oligarchs and what money may have been laundered through the Trump organization.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also important to recognize that Angela Merkel herself issued a shot across the bow last week when she made it very clear who was in charge in Europe and who was someone he was going to have to contend with if he wanted to dissolve NATO, which, of course, he flirted with during the during the primary and during the general election. I mean, you know, there are, as I said, there are no shortage of things to be concerned with respect to Trump, but it is a serious job. And the fact of the matter is that this is a man who has a very mixed record as a businessman, has had to file for bankruptcy multiple times, never released his tax returns, has been implicated in multiple cases of racial discrimination against workers and against tenants in his building. This is someone who has a child rape case that's pending that's supposed to go to court in December. He's involved in 17 other legal disputes. His relationship with Putin is certainly something that is of deep concern and that may have had some influence on the election in terms of the hacking and the release of information on WikiLeaks. That was a kind of slow drip throughout this throughout the general election. So yeah, it is a serious job, and I don't think Donald Trump is a particularly serious person. He's certainly someone who has shown very little capacity to work hard and to be intellectually curious. Both of those are traits that one would hope that the president would embody. Certainly, the President Obama, Vice President Biden, and Secretary Clinton all embody. It's very clear that all of them are serious people, that they work hard, that they're willing to test their own ideas and try to do whatever they can to legislate as progressively as they're able. And I share many of our compatriots' concerns about, and also many of our friends and allies in other countries. I share the deep concern that's really a global concern about what we've done here in the United States by putting Donald Trump in a position where he can be the next president of the United States. But that said, I want to pivot for a second, because I think it's really important for us to, while we're doing the autopsies and while we're, as I like to say to my students, de-griefing from the election, as opposed to debriefing from the election, I think it's also important for us to understand that this is a moment, I think, where a movement must emerge. That I think we, you know, one of the things that has been a bright light for me, at least, and for many of us in the last week or so, has been the unbelievable outpouring, not only of grief and of anger and of shock and despair, but also of organizing. I mean, you know, you have campuses all across the country, including my own here at Harvard, that are calling on their administrations to designate themselves as sanctuary campuses, colleges and universities, where undocumented students and their families can feel a sense of protection and safety. We have a growing demands for women's rights and reproductive justice. I think that the failure to elect Hillary Clinton, not only as the first major woman candidate from one of America's political parties, but also the most qualified person to run for the presidency in my lifetime, I think, without exception, the failure to do that has energized millions and millions and millions of American women, even American women who may not have been thrilled with the candidacy of Hillary Clinton or with the person of Hillary Clinton, are energized to work on behalf of women's rights and reproductive justice and the rights of women and girls, human rights, gender rights globally. You see that happening. We already have a robust Black Lives Matter movement that has completely shaped and influenced the discourse on racial justice in this country, on race and policing, on the legacies of slavery and segregation, racial violence and white supremacy. We have an LGBT movement that has been incredibly successful at advancing civil rights for LGBT people in this country and resisting the assaults by people on the right, including people like Mike Pence, against transgender folks, against other more vulnerable members of the LGBTQ community. So we have, I think, emerging, not just in this moment in the last week, but emerging in the last decade or so, a whole series of social justice movements, of progressive movements for social change that have sought to not only resist the onslaught that comes from the right, but also to defend and advance the rights of people who are vulnerable in this society, and also to provide our own ways of keeping people safe and secure. We often talk about safety and security as if it's a foreign policy objective or a homeland security objective, but I think safety and security has to become a civil rights and human rights and social justice imperative for the left and for the Democratic Party insofar as it has a relationship with the left. So I see at this very difficult and treacherous moment, one that should shock us into action, the possibility for a growing, multifaceted progressive movement that can not only influence the way the Democratic Party engages in its own forms of resistance, but also legislation at this moment, but also that reinvigorates the kind of spirit and imagination of the country so that those progressive, that progressive turn in the electorate among the American people, among ordinary folks of different backgrounds, can become a reality, that we can take, that we can really take back our country and set it again on a path towards greatness, as opposed to engaging in some kind of anger and anxiety-fueled set of resentments and nostalgia that would take us back 50 years to a place when most of us would say was not a particularly great place for most Americans. Most Americans 50 years ago, when Donald Trump thinks America was great, did not have rights, did not have opportunities, did not have the kinds of freedoms and equalities and aspirations and dreams that we now have, that we've tasted in different ways in more modern times. And so, you know, I see this as a movement moment as much as a moment for despair and for anger and for resentment and division. And so I hope that we on the liberal left progressive democratic side of things, and we are a majority, that we seize this moment to make America great in a very different way than I think Donald Trump and Mike Pence and Reince Priebus and Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and all of their folks can imagine.
Well, just in the last minute, apart from renaming my program from Background Briefing to Background Griefing, today Trump met with South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, Representative Jeb Hensarling, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. He also met with the head of Oracle, with General Jack Keane. He used to be Hillary Clinton's advisor, National Security Agency Chief Admiral Mike Rogers. That's an extraordinary thing. If anybody knows about the Russian connections, it's the NSA. And then, of course, Family Research Council, Ken Blackwell, and then Fred Smith, of the head of CEO of FedEx, and then finally Governor Rick Scott of Florida, the biggest felon in the world in terms of his settlements for stealing from Medicaid, and he may be the next head of Health and Human Services. So pretty strange crew, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is a mess. We know that about him, right? I mean, I follow him on Twitter. A lot of people follow him on Twitter. He's a mess. He's all over the place. He doesn't have any kind of ideological or intellectual or ethical or political consistency. I'm not saying that if you are president of the United States, you have to be completely consistent. After all, I mean, President Obama evolved on marriage equality and became a much more full-throated champion of LGBT rights during his time. So people can change. They can evolve. They can make their own progress, but Donald Trump is all over the place. And that's what I'm so worried about, and that's what was at the root, I think, of Hillary Clinton's claims that he was unfit, temperamentally unfit for the presidency. I mean, if you just follow his Twitter feed, I'm a historian, if you use his Twitter feed as an archive to make sense of the man and the mindset, you are going to have a very difficult time doing that because he's absolutely all over the place. The one thing that is consistent about Donald Trump is that he's a bully. He is a bully, and that he spends his life responding in thin-skinned ways to anybody who challenges him, and that he lashes out against people that he perceives to be weaker than he is. And those are the things that are consistent about him, and those are the things that make him, in my mind, totally unfit to be president of the United States. But we're going to have to figure out a way to get through this, and we're going to have to come up with really creative ways and strategic ways. We're going to have a short-term plan, a middle-term plan, and a long-term plan. There's got to be an electoral strategy, but there's also got to be a progressive movement strategy, because a lot of us, for the next 4 years, if not 8 years, are going to be on the outside of politics and policymaking. And we have to figure out, how do we have an outside strategy to influence the politics and culture of the country so that we can reclaim this and that we can resist the worst tendencies of a Trump presidency?
Well, Timothy McCarthy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy, and the director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism. And we're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the new White House National Security Team.
You may be surprised, people in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Yes.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and is the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco, The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East, and his forthcoming book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn, Gun for Hire. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And it's a pretty extraordinary group of people that Donald Trump has already met with today. He's met with South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, Representative Jeb Hensarling, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and he also met with the CEO of Oracle, General Jack Keane, who used to be a Hillary Clinton advisor, the National Security Agency Chief, Admiral Mike Rogers, which is pretty interesting, the Family Research Council's Ken Blackwell, the CEO of FedEx, and Florida's Governor Rick Scott, who's rumored to be the next head of Health and Human Services. But he apparently is doing photo ops with a prize fighter and taking time off to do celebrity interviews for TMZ, while the Vice President, Mike Pence, is doing all the heavy lifting. So is this a precursor of the Trump presidency?
Well, Mike Pence is a professional. He knows how Washington works. Trump ran as an outsider. He vowed to change the way Washington works. When you assume the office of the presidency, you have to negotiate and compromise. That's not something that's in Trump's DNA. But he's going to have to learn how to impose some discipline on his administration. The meeting schedule that you just outlined shows greater discipline. So does the fact that the Trump transition team signed an MOU with the Obama administration today that allows them to start sharing information and facilitating the transfer of power.
But that should have happened weeks ago, surely.
It hasn't been that long since the election.
Right,
it should have happened sooner than it was did.
Right.
But other transitions have been chaotic. It takes time.
Right.
And Trump's transition is going to be particularly chaotic because look at the campaign he ran. It was completely chaotic. Now, he's vowed to drain the swamp of business as usual in Washington. I mean, let's see if he really does that.
So your piece in the Huffington Post about Michael Flynn, the Lieutenant General, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, he was eased out of the DIA, I believe, because he says he was clashed over the fight against radical Islam. As far as I can tell, the Islamic State's on the ropes in Mosul and in Raqqa, but apparently he had a different approach. And he was, of course, prominent in the campaign and at the Republican convention, even yelling to the crowd, lock her up, lock her up. So And he also went to Russia on Putin's dime, sat next to Putin. The whole thing is pretty strange, and yet he's very likely to be the next national security advisor, I'm told.
So Trump made a vow that nobody could join his administration if they were former government officials and were involved in lobbying activities. The big irony here is that on Election Day, the general published an article in which he praised Turkey's President Erdogan and almost verbatim echoed Turkey's policy recommendations. It then came to light that he was being paid as a lobbyist by a Dutch company, which is wholly owned by a Turkish company, and the owner of the Turkish company is in lockstep with President Erdogan and generates most of its revenues through government contracts. So if the money, in fact, for the general is coming from the government of Turkey, he would have been required to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. He didn't do that. He was taking money through this front organization. You know, a lot of ethical questions and questions about his judgment arise from this.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary that that the national security team itself, when you've got being named as possible Secretary of Defense Senator Jeff Sessions and Tom Cotton, but the one that's most disturbing of all, and it's, you know, something that you're familiar with since you worked for the State Department, David Phillips, is the possibility of John Bolton. I mean, apparently, Jared Kushner, who's the son-in-law, has quite a lot of influence. He's a huge booster of Bolton. Even though Trump himself says he was opposed to the Iraq War, Bolton was one of the champions of the Iraq War. Now he wants to go after Iran, even though the stupidity of the Iraq War was that it made Iran stronger. And apparently also Trump's biggest donor, Mercer, the hedge fund guy, along with his wife, Rebecca, are huge boosters of Bolton because of his support of Netanyahu's right-wing government in Israel. So is there a chance that Bolton and therefore the neocons could come back?
So it's too soon to tell who's going to be on the national security team. And John Bolton's name has definitely been mentioned, and there's a good chance that he might be Secretary of State, or that his former spokesman, Richard Grenell, could be the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Bolton famously pronounced that you could take off the top 10 floors of the United Nations Secretariat and nobody would know the difference. So, you know, he is rabid in his attacks. To his credit, he was also rabid as an advocate for the victims in Darfur and to stop ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. So over the course of one's career, you have to look at the body of work, and usually there are contradictory signals about how somebody's going to behave. I think what we do know about John Bolton is that he's always on the attack. If he's attacking institutions and principles that the United States and the American people hold dear, then he's going to be a liability.
Well, but the disconnect here is between what Trump tried to campaign on. I mean, one of the things that was so interesting about Trump was that he did attack the Bush administration's mistakes, largely the Iraq War. And basically described it as the disaster that it was. He falsely claimed that he opposed the war. But nevertheless, how do you reconcile what Trump has claimed as his sort of ideas and foreign policy, or at least his critique, with Bolton's huge support for the Iraq War?
So I've come to realize that almost everything Donald Trump said in the campaign is totally meaningless. They weren't policy positions. He wasn't recommending programs. He was just trying to roil the emotions of the American people and be a contrarian. So now he has to reinvent his policies and programs. He needs to have a more reality-based approach. When you assemble a national security team, you're going to have a collection of different personalities. For sure, those personalities include people with dubious backgrounds who are ideological and have made some serious mistakes that embroiled the United States in wars in the Middle East. But we'll see who those personalities are. We'll see what positions they get and what kind of balance there is in the national security team. We also have to see whether or not they're going to be making policy or whether or not President-elect Trump is going to do that for himself. It's entirely possible that he'll appoint these personalities and then deprive them of any real authority. Too soon to tell on all these fronts.
And, of course, the opposite is equally true, right? That he'll be a hands-off president. And right?
Yes, that's a real possibility. He could be totally disengaged,
right.
Completely disinterested. Mm-hmm. He could leave it to his vice president and members of his cabinet to take the initiative. But everything we know about Donald Trump from the campaign suggests that he wants to have his hands on everything. When you're president of the United States, it's different than sitting up late at night and sending tweets. You have to actually govern, lead, inspire. So far, we haven't seen qualities in Donald Trump that suggest he's going to be very presidential.
Well, today in Germany, standing beside Angela Merkel, President Obama in the press conference said, "The presidency is a serious job, and if you are not serious about it, you will not last long." Now, that's clearly a dig at Donald Trump. But these rumors that have been swirling for some time about the fact that some people in the historian at American University has also said, Alan Lichtman, that he thinks that Trump will be impeached within the first year. The meeting today with the head of the National Security Agency is very strange to my mind, because there's so much that the intelligence community is sitting on, apparently, about Trump's ties to Putin and why it is that he praises Putin all the time and the extent to which he's indebted to Russian money. We don't know, because he never released his tax returns. We don't know what the relationship is there and who he owes money to and who could possibly be blackmailing him. So it's a very strange moment, don't you think, to be about to have an inauguration at the same time people talking about impeachment.
And there are scores of lawsuits that are being filed against Donald Trump and his various enterprises. There's also the question of the family business being put in a blind trust, which is typical for a president. But in this case, Trump wants to assign custodianship of the blind trust to his children. He's also saying that he wants his children to be given top secret security clearances, which is highly unusual. So with Donald Trump as president, we don't know what to expect, except that he'll do things differently than they've ever done before. Whether or not that compromises U.S. national security remains to be seen. We do know that there are some serious problems out there in the world. You know, Obama was meeting with Chancellor Merkel today, talking about the migrant and refugee crisis. Now, how is the Trump administration going to handle that? And will the election of Donald Trump embolden the far right in Europe? And will we see far right-wing politicians like Marine Le Pen elected president in France? Now, there's a big wild card in world affairs right now, and Donald Trump has put everything in play.
Well, just in closing, you were in the White House today, David Phillips. The presidency is a very serious job, as the president said today in Germany. It's also a place where it has enormous power, enormous responsibility. So that's the question, isn't it, that we're left with. Will he exercise the powers and even to the point pushing the envelope on his powers, or will he be an absentee landlord?
So the first thing that the president does every morning is he sits down with his intelligence briefers, and he gets something called the Presidential Daily Brief, which is essentially a summary of all of the threats that have emerged over the past 24 hours to the United States. That must be an extremely sobering experience every morning. The presidency is not a playground. The presidency requires a dead serious leader. Maybe Trump will learn on the job. So far, we don't know what to expect, But we have seen how President Obama matured in his office and how he ended up being a good president. Will Trump mature and also become a good president? The jury is out on that. Let's hope that we don't have to wait 2 terms or 4 years to find out.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's always good to speak with you.
Thank you, David. And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book, An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, is coming out soon. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn, Gun for Hire. This is going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with John Densmore, the original and founding member of The Doors. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is John Densmore, an original and founding member of The Doors, who co-wrote and produced numerous gold and platinum albums. And his autobiography, Riders in the Storm, was on the New York Times bestseller list, and he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993. And his latest book is The Doors Unhinged. Well, welcome to Background Briefing, John Densmore.
Ian, you know, been a fan of your show for many years, and now I'm on it. Feels good.
Feels good to me, too. And this is a time when people's spirits need to be lifted up. This is a time when people feel defeated, but on the other hand, they really haven't been defeated. Hillary Clinton won by 2 million votes by any measure that democracies operate on around the world, which is first past the post. Donald Trump only got 107,000 more votes in the key Rust Belt states that gave him the Electoral College majority. So it's hardly a mandate, but that's not going to stop this right-wing cabal from taking this mandate and running with it.
Oh, my goodness. So up until recently, we have hoped that politicians would speak the truth. Poets metaphorically have to speak the truth or their poetry isn't any good. And that's why, you know, besides holding Trump's feet to the fire and getting out on the street, you know, artists can help out. And Robert Bly, an old mentor of mine, wonderful poet, knew how to put his activism with his art.
Well, but both you and Robert Bly were very early protesters of the Vietnam War, were you not?
Most definitely. Well, maybe I should read this little thing now. I have a
few pages
about...
But let's just give it some context what he actually did in terms of protesting the war, because it wasn't popular to protest the Vietnam War in the early days.
No. And this is in my third book, and it's, it's self-explanatory. Here we go, all right? In the 60s, with the Southeast Asian, quote, conflict, end quote, escalating, Robert Bly won the National Book Award for Light Around the Body, which contained strong anti-war poetry. I had heard of his outrageous acceptance speech for winning the award, which endeared me to him further because my early struggles were avoiding the conflict. David Ignatow, a winner of the Bollinger Prize for Poetry, describes the moment. To Robert, at first, the idea of accepting a prize in the middle of a war of devastation upon innocent people was obscene and a travesty of the high purpose of poetry itself. He was rejecting the prize outright, he wanted to, with a written scathing denunciation, but decided to accept it on the condition he'd be allowed to speak. It was unusual. Usually you're supposed to say thank you and get off the stage. The speech was written among his fellow poets just hours before the ceremony, and it was an amazing moment in the hall when Robert, after quietly receiving the check, turned to the audience with his speech in hand and began to read it in his measured, angry voice. We had been forewarned there would be FBI agents in the audience. He denounced the war. He denounced the writers in the audience, which had been idly sitting by, letting the war take its frightful course without a word of conscience or protest. And finally, he denounced the publishers themselves who had contributed toward the prize money and his own publisher in particular for its silence. Yeah. A hush fell upon the auditorium as he called out the name of the representative of the War Resisters League, gave him the check, and urged him to refuse the draft. Open encouragement was tantamount to a violation of a law that had recently been passed by Congress. As we looked around, we became aware of about 10 men dressed in dark suits, and they rose up from their seats in different parts of the hall. Parenthesis, Galway Connell, the future Pulitzer, was afraid Robert would be arrested on the spot. Then the plainclothesmen walked out altogether. The rest of the audience now began an uproar of talk, and mixed with boos and cheers, I was apprehensive that the worst was yet to come, but for now we had won the day and put on notice the government before this distinguished audience composed of most of the major literary figures of the day and their publisher that this war could not be suppressed in our thoughts, not in our lives, and had to be met honestly and with conscience.
So, again, I'm speaking with John Densmore, who's joined me in the studio. He's an original founding member of The Doors, who co-wrote and produced numerous gold and platinum albums and toured the United States, Europe, and Japan. His autobiography, Riders on the Storm, was on the New York Times bestseller list, and he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993, and his latest book is The Doors Unhinged. So this is a time, though, John.
Isn't that kind of a wonderful way to use it to hold Trump's feet to the fire?
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. And the thing that I wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure a lot of the people in the audience are, because they don't really know Robert Bly well, they associate him with men's liberation, which is something right. that he didn't feel comfortable with himself.
Well, I'll give you the background briefing okay. on that.
All right, go for it.
Well, I was in the early men's group, and actually it was... I had a couple divorces, and the processing really helped me. It was, you know, when groups get together, like gender groups or alcoholics or whatever, you know, there's a healing. So Robert in the early days said, if this is ever called a movement, we're in trouble. Well, ultimately, it got so big, he was the butt of sitcom jokes and called Hitler by some feminists in Europe. What wasn't understood was it was not an answer to the women's movement. It was emulating what women have done all along, shared their feelings, rather than the traditional male bonding of sports and beer.
You're talking to an Australian, John. we're manly men. We don't show emotions.
Yes. Well, so, you know, that really fed me. And I would say that... It jumpstart the Million Man March ultimately too, so there was some good.
Right,
Iron John, the book on it, was number one for a year or whatever.
But in terms of the moment, though, the sense of loss that the first woman couldn't become president, they couldn't break the glass ceiling, is pretty extraordinary when you think of all of the other advanced nations that have had women leaders for the longest time. And this is a time when people may be asking, why do we need a men's movement as opposed to buttressing the women's movement?
Well, it was a movement to make men more sensitive to women, thank you. And I loved what Louis C.K. said before the election. You vote for Hillary not because she's a woman, because she's a mother. And you know how they are. They won't stop.
So 2 million more people voted for her. Let's get that straight.
Ian, I'm 71. Damn it. Come on, Elizabeth Warren or someone. I want to see a woman, please, before I check out.
Well, tell us about the film then, because some of the people in it are pretty interesting. And, we all know Garrison Keillor, and Mark Rylance, the great British actor, Martin Shaw, Martin Sheen, etc. So what is this, your involvement with it? And tell us about the film itself. I guess what you're trying to do is to to put this man's life into context, A Thousand Years of Joy?
Well, you know, he started out kind of a uptight 50s Norwegian...
bachelor farmer.
Exactly. Right. You know, I went to New York, starving artist, and bumped into the Beats and started to change and realize, wow, academia is not the way to go. And, you know, most of his poetry that got the most attention was infused with anti-war vibrations. It was a mentor for me because the byproduct of going to these men's groups, I had thought poetry was just all about flowers till I did this. And then Robert was reading his translation of Kabir from India.
Rumi.
Rumi, right. Neruda, just tons of them. And I just got fed, mm-hmm. you know, and it kind of helped me jumpstart my second way of artistic communication, writing. And I'm on my third book and written a bunch of articles for the LA Times and various, The Nation. Tom Hayden, the late, great Tom Hayden, edited my first piece. And, you know, like Tom, Robert is a mentor, you know, someone mm-hmm. I can look to, feeds me to keep going and do it with vigor.
But when you started out, though, in your relationship with Robert Bly, was that at the time when the Doors were active?
Well, it was after that, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I was this famous rock and roller, but, you know, like everyone else, I had relationship struggles and had to go to the bathroom and you know, mm-hmm. and it was helpful to process.
So what do you think the audience are going to get from this film? Because, you know, it's good to talk to you because quite simply, I'm like much of the audience. We don't know a lot about this man, and what we think we know about him is probably somewhat misleading.
Oh, well, as the also late, great Leonard Cohen wrote in one of his lyrics, revenge is just reserved for the Lord. Well, I think now that we've anointed Donald, he's always probably thought he was the Lord, but pretty frightening. We've got to hold his feet to the fire every minute he gets weird. Maybe something good will slip through mm-hmm. here and there. I'm trying to stay open to that. I mean, it's possible. I couldn't believe what Republican has ever said that the Iraqi war was, you know, the worst thing that ever happened in American history. Went, hello, right. Thank you. Is the truth. Like,
no, it got my attention when it happened. Yeah.
Truth.
Yeah. No, and he said it in front of Bush's brother, too.
So maybe here and there he will spew out something brilliant, and I've just got to pray for all the rest because it's pretty scary.
But in terms of Robert Bly, Trump is the opposite of what you were describing, what the movement and what Bly meant could mean for men and should mean for men.
Yeah.
It sounds like, in many ways, given his dominant father— he apparently, according to his biographer, he is a total tyrant, controls his world. His kids are almost like members of a cult.
We're talking about
Donald Trump,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Literally, they look kind of like zombies. His wife looks like a Stepford wife.
Mm.
There's something about him. It seems like he inherited that kind of the opposite of a liberated man from his father. He could have done with a bit of Robert Bly.
A 50s male who... You know, you're supposed to never cry and drink beer and you know, the 60s came along and we grew our hair and got a little more introspective and sensitive. And Donald does have hair, but I think it's just...
And he doesn't drink, by the way.
Yes, I think it's external, the hair. Yeah, drinking, well... I'm Irish. A little nip occasionally feeds me, but...
But what do you think, though, in terms of whether or not Donald Trump, because this is the other aspect of this horrible situation we're in. The reason Donald Trump won, and this has been verified by both Hillary Clinton and by Lewandowski, Trump's former top aide who was fired.
Right.
They both have said that the election was the scales were tipped in Trump's favor by the FBI director. And there's no question to my mind, since I know a bit about the FBI, it's a complete Republican operation. It's full of right-wing Catholics, many of whom are Opus Dei, that right-wing Catholic cult. It's not inconceivable that Comey is a member of that secretive cult, but there's no question that it feels like the revenge of the patriarchy, that the patriarchy struck back at the last minute. They couldn't stand the idea of a woman being president, particularly a feminist who's pro-choice, and they stitched her up, and they elected Trump.
I was raised Catholic, Ian, but I'm a renegade Catholic, thank you. I'm a Berrigan Brothers Catholic, you know? I guess I underestimated the middle of the country a bit. I can't find the words. I don't have the solution. I mean, I know I'm just going to keep doing my art, and I'm going to go out in the street when I can, if it's right, you know?
So are you in touch with him?
A little, you know, he's
a little over the hill, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're all heading there, I can tell you that. So,
but it empowers me not to give up the fight. You know, one time I asked Joseph Campbell, wonderful mythologist, I said, well, you know, he had this great overview that joyful participation in the sorrows of the world. And I said, but Joe, I don't want to have that wonderful overview undermine fighting fascists like Hitler or whatever. And he said, you fight the good fight. And then if you get a little too crazy and frayed at the edges, remember, there's a bigger overview, but you keep fighting.
Well, it sounds like I spoke with Bernie Sanders yesterday, and he's got some pretty solid ideas of what we must do and where we must head. And he showed the way in many ways in the campaign by attracting the young people. And by the way, The Economist did a poll on who's the most trusted politicians in America, and he's far and ahead the leader.
Bernie, I introduced Bernie at Irvine Meadows in front of 8,000 people in Orange County, and it was so exhilarating and hopeful. So when Trump does something stupid, Bernie's army, we got to go out.
And 2 years' time, elect a new House and new Senate.
Yeah.
And then in 4 years' time, elect a new
female
House, Senate. Well, again, and a female president. Right? And she may be from the state of Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, Maggie Thatcher was not the most wonderful. I mean, but let's try it, okay?
Yeah.
Can we, you know?
Well, this is what's so extraordinary, that we're so far behind in that regard, and yet women in this country hold up more than half the world. 45% of households are led by a woman who's the principal breadwinner.
Mm.
It was the men who elected Trump. The men are angry.
Mm.
So just in closing, what's the Robert Bly, John Densmore message to the men who voted for Trump?
Oh, boy, you are tough. Well, I kind of like that Michael Moore line. Don't worry. The minorities are here and going to run the whole thing, and we didn't do so well, so let's see how they do.
Not to mention the Native Americans who were here before there were even minorities, and they're getting beaten up there in North Dakota.
Tell me about it.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.